So here's your host, Susan Gallimore, with another edition of Raising Sand Radio.
Hey,
and today we'll hear from former U.S. Army enlistee Andre Shepherd, who applied for asylum in Germany on November 26, 2008. This because on the grounds of conscience, he refused to redeploy to Iraq, and he now lives with other asylum seekers, mainly Iraqis and Afghans, in a facility provided by the German government. We'll also talk with Donna Baranski-Walker, executive director of the nonprofit, actually the local Palo Alto-based nonprofit, the Rebuilding Alliance. So that, again, is local, and we'll hear all about what the Rebuilding Alliance does. And the following interview is pre-recorded with Andre Shepherd. This was pre-recorded on Skype while he is in Germany. Andre Shepherd applied for asylum in Germany in November 26, 2008, and now lives with other asylum seekers, mainly Iraqis and Afghans, in a facility provided by the German government. He's the first U.S. resistor to turn to the German government for help. His case is presently before the German Federal Office of Migration, and it raises significant issues in international and in German law. The German Constitution forbids the preparation of aggressive war from German soil, a provision that some jurists believe applies also to the U.S. military. Welcome, Andre Shepherd.
Hi, and thanks for having me on.
Well, it's great to have you. We have you on Skype today, so the audio sometimes gets a little tricky, but we'll just do the best we can. Andre Shepherd, yesterday President Barack Obama was in Germany after making that historic speech in Cairo. How was he received in Germany?
As far as I know, there's still a lot of support from the local nationals in Germany because they view Obama as the change agent that's going to make the world a safer and better place.
And your message for President Obama is a little different, isn't it?
Yes, that is correct, because to be honest, I view this trip to Germany as a little bit hypocritical, considering that he's showing himself as someone who's going to change the direction of U.S. foreign policy, while at the same time continuing the policies that have been laid down since the Clinton administration in the late 90s.
Well, say a little more about that, because we have, that speech he made in Cairo really was a huge change from the last 8 years. So there's a little bit of good, and there's a little bit of you, as you say, perhaps hypocrisy.
Yes, the reason why I say these things is because Barack Obama has been known to make a lot of good speeches. However, when he's asked to actually capitalize on the things that he's been talking about, he's always reversed course. Take, for example, the latest thing that's happened with these torture photos, where his administration was willing to release them for public viewing so we could see what exactly we have done, you know, to these poor individuals in the last 8 years in Guantanamo Bay. And then he had a sudden change of reversal, saying that these things are too graphic and he wanted to protect U.S. soldiers, which I personally don't believe so, and many others don't believe so, because we feel that we will see just how depraved the U.S. government has gotten when it comes into this war on terror. And then if you look at another example, the war on terror, which they now are calling the overseas contingency operations, is ramping up even more so than in the last 8 years. We still have a massive military presence in Iraq, even though they signed the SOFA agreement, but they're trying to redraw the boundaries of the city, so it looks like that the U.S. soldiers aren't in the city when in fact they are. They're trying to keep 14 bases open beyond the deadline, and they're trying to expand the forces in Afghanistan and expand operations into Pakistan as well, which is killing so many civilians and destroying families and homes and the infrastructures of these countries, all to profit the weapons makers, the drug dealers, as well as the oil companies.
Well, Andre Shepherd, you joined the U.S. Army in 2004, and you were trained as a helicopter mechanic and subsequently stationed in Germany. How did you come to these different points of view that you're holding these days?
For me to change my complete outlook on life, especially when it comes to the United States standing in the world, this took a really long journey, about a year and a half. It started when I was in Iraq and spoke with Iraqis down there who were brought on base to help us maintain the base or even fill sandbags to protect our, what we call hooches, which is our living quarters at the time. And they were telling us about the things that were going on, about the kidnapping, the raping the people, the complete destruction of cities, how they didn't have enough clean running water or electricity or anything like that. And for myself and a few others, we were completely shocked at what we heard, because this was completely different than what we were told what the U.S. military stood for. And then the Battle of Fallujah came, and when we found out that the entire city was completely destroyed in the fashion like it was back in Vietnam or something, this also started sending alarm bells in my head. So those two events started me on this path to find out what exactly was going on in the world when it came to U.S. foreign policy, as to the reasons behind the Iraq War to begin with, but also to go back further to the war on terror. And the things that I have discovered, not only the lies about the Iraq War, but also the questionable nature of our objective in Afghanistan, is really shocking. And I looked at our entire operation as nothing but murdering the civilian population, or to bring them under control in order for us to extract their wealth for Western consumption. And this is something I don't agree with.
And so what does it mean to apply for asylum? You came to this new way of thinking, and your next step was?
Well, I came to this thinking, first, there were two major decisions. In 2007, I walked away from the Army entirely because they wanted to send me back to Iraq, and I didn't want to. So I ended up walking away from the military altogether. And for two years...
Now, what does that mean? You went AWOL?
Yes, that's correct. I went AWOL.
In Germany?
And yes, that's correct. So what ended up happening was it closed the door to return to the United States, because once I walked off the military base and onto German soil, if I wanted to go back to the United States, I would need to go through customs. And since there would be a warrant out for my arrest, I would be automatically arrested. So that pretty much closed the door, perhaps forever, to return to the United States. In the meantime, I tried to immigrate normally into the German society, but that wasn't possible because they needed confirmation from the Army that I left legally. So when that didn't work, and also by keeping tabs on what was going on inside of America and then also during the war via the internet and talking to different Americans that would come through and everything, I came to the decision that in order to bring these atrocities to an end, that we would have to do something. So it was there were two reasons behind why I applied for asylum. One was a personal reason, because I needed to have a normal life again, to be able to work, eventually raise a family, things like this. But the other side, too, was because we really need to stop the madness that's going on, especially since 2001. And for myself and also others like Joshua Key in Canada, who are fighting for asylum, we're not just doing this for ourselves. We're doing this for the thousands of other soldiers who have deserted since these wars have begun.
To apply for asylum, you went to the German Federal Office of Migration. And what did you hear there?
When I went there, the mood was actually pretty good. I was completely shocked because I expected them to laugh me out of the office when I first got there. The exact opposite happened. They were very understanding, and a few actually told me that they were surprised that an American soldier hasn't done this since these operations began over the last 8 years. The office workers were really happy to see this happen, but I do not know what's going on with the decision makers, actually, because since this is a very complicated case, when you look at the political side of this, this is such a highly charged case, because the decision made by the German government could have lasting ramifications, not only for Germany and U.S. relations, but ultimately for NATO as well.
And are you getting a lot of publicity for this case over there?
In Germany, yes. We've had a widespread coverage. Worldwide, it's also been very good. I've gotten interviews from as far away as Japan and Russia even, and also even mentioned in news publications in Iran and what have you. And there was also a few articles out of New Zealand as well. In the United States, it's not so good for obvious reasons, because since the mainstream media is, from what we see, is nothing more than the propaganda arm of the U.S. government, they're not too keen on trying to cover a case like this, but rather trying to make this into a non-story. This is what my view of this is for the last 7 months.
See a lot of support amongst the German people.
The German people that I've talked to, I found very, very few people who are against what I've done. It's been overwhelming support among the German people, and I'm very happy to hear that.
Yeah. Now, there's a clause in the German Constitution forbidding the preparation of aggressive war from German soil. This is something that they're aware of, I would imagine, and this is why they're supporting you?
I believe so. They also have been against these wars overall since they've begun. The majority of German people are against the war in Iraq and Afghanistan as well. They did a recent poll in the last couple of weeks saying that over 60% are against Afghanistan too. So they're really happy to see that the American soldiers do not represent the U.S. government, because all of us have a conscience. Now, this clause in the German Constitution, which from reading back in history, I assume that the U.S. helped write, since they were one of the conquering powers at the end of World War II, that the U.S. government is well aware of this. But we have seen how the government, especially this decade, has pretty much ignored everyone's will, including their own, in order to wage these wars of aggression.
We're talking with Andre Shepherd, formerly of the United States military and the Army, who has applied to Germany, the German Federal Office of Migration, for asylum so that he does not have to redeploy to Iraq. Well, of course, at this point, since you're still officially AWOL, is there any possibility that the American military could, or the Army could get you again and redeploy you? I mean, this would be one way to get you out of the picture and quiet, isn't it?
Well, this would be very difficult for them to do so, because if you read Article 85, which is the clause for desertion, the basic tenet in that is intent. And this is the thing. As soon as I applied for asylum in Germany, the intention was clear that I have no desire to return to the military. And because the desertion has the death penalty attached to it, it's very difficult for the military to explain to the German government how this could not be a possibility, even though they could possibly argue that this hasn't been done since World War II. But we also know that the U.S. government could say things on one side and do things on the other side. We don't know.
Mm-hmm.
For them to take me back and to redeploy me, that's also an open-ended question, because depending on who goes before the military tribunals with the UCMJ violations, they base it on an individual basis. So whether or not they would just send me back to Iraq, I don't know. But I know for certain if they did get their hand on me again, I would spend quite some time in jail and also have potential felony conviction back in the United States, which would make my life extremely difficult. And this is why I say that I would face political persecution, because in this respect, my life would be completely ruined, only because I was one of the few thousand that actually did the right thing during this entire mess.
So the best discharge that you could get from the military is what, an other than honorable?
That one is hard to say. In the case of desertion, I'm quite sure it's a dishonorable discharge.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, AWOL and desertion are kind of two separate things, aren't they? Desertion, as you say, is a capital crime. AWOL is absent without leave is a slightly different crime.
Yes, that is correct. And the reason why it would go to desertion is because AWOL is when you stay away, you can be 30 days or less and you return back to the military.
Mm-hmm.
And for desertion, it could be beyond 30 days, but they have to prove that the intention was clear that you didn't want to come back.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as I made an official proclamation to literally pretty much trade in my citizenship to go for protection with a foreign government, the intention is clear. I don't see any other way of them trying to explain it in a different way.
Okay.
And so under the rules of the UCMJ, I would be listed as a deserter.
Okay. And Andre, who are the other asylum seekers?
Right now, currently, the majority of them that I have met in the last 7 months are mainly from Iraq and Afghanistan.
How does that work?
And
how do you get Iraqis and Afghans applying for asylum in Germany? And why would they apply for asylum there?
The reason why they would be applying for asylum is because their lives have been completely shattered back in the countries that they've come from. Because of U.S. interference in these two countries, where they've completely toppled governments and destabilized the country, they could be either A, running away from the violence that was caused by the power vacuum that the U.S. has created, or because they have nowhere to turn to because their entire homes are devastated, there's no drinking water, there's no electricity. With the use of depleted uranium, especially in Iraq, they've got cancer rates going off the charts. The future is really bleak. So these same people are coming to the Western world asking for refuge where they can actually put their shattered lives back together, where had we not intervened, the numbers of people from these countries would be significantly less.
And about how many Iraqis and Afghans would you say are in the same situation that you are right now in Germany applying for asylum?
In this case, I don't have exact numbers. In just the reception center I was in, there's on average between 30 and 40 a week coming in. But
Okay.
You cannot quote me on that.
Uh-huh.
I mean, usually people come in on a weekly basis.
Uh-huh.
And between groups of 30 and 40, the majority of them are from Iraq and Afghanistan.
Interesting. Well, what would you like to share with other resistors around the world? Actually, as you mentioned, there are now resistors in Canada. There are thousands of resistors in the United States. I know there have been a few other. Augustin Gayo comes to mind. He applied in Germany, but he didn't apply for asylum from the German government. So is there anything you'd like to say to the resistors?
Well, I would like to tell everybody to never give up. None of us are ever alone. Even though we don't keep in contact with each other, which is good because it's good to stay separated just to stay out of the spotlight, always remember that all of us are in this together and that we're all fighting together for the exact same goal. I hope that with success in this asylum case, then we actually have a place that we can call home, even if it's not the United States of America, because they refuse to help us.
And that's a point in itself, isn't it? There's a sense that a lot of Americans, this is barely on their radar. I mean, your case is fairly complex, but even the war in Afghanistan and Iraq sometimes seems as though it's barely breaking into people's consciousness in the United States.
Yes, and I put the majority of the blame on the mainstream media, because what they've done, what I've noticed, is that because of the lessons learned from Vietnam, from the military perspective, where the media had unfettered access to everything, and it turned public opinion against the war. The military didn't want to have this again. So now the media has been pretty much marginalized, where they haven't really shown what exactly is happening in these conflict areas. So the people, in the people's mind eye, the war is in a completely different part of the world. They don't see it. It's not in their face. So it's back to the out of sight, out of mind rule. So a lot of people do not realize what exactly is going on, except for these government propaganda pieces that come out regularly in the mainstream media.
And would you say that that's where you were before you came to this realization, actually in the war zone already, that you really didn't have a sense of how the system worked in the United States?
Yes, that's correct, because given my economic situation, I didn't have access to the Internet. That was one of the big things, because I was living out of my car for quite some time. And the only news I would get is if I would look at NBC or CNN or something like this, or even just reading the daily paper. And we only got the one side that was the pro-American side, which is good, I mean, for patriotism and everything, but if you're going to do something as serious as go to war where people are going to die, you need to have all sides of the story. And that is what the American people never got. It's been revealed that the Bush administration lied to the people and the world over 900 times, and the people still are getting all the information as to what is going on. If it wasn't for the alternative media that has put out a dissonant voice, I don't even think we would have gotten this far.
Mm-hmm. Andre, I want to just come back for a moment. You said you were living in your car, but you were in college. You were in Kent State University, weren't you?
Yes, that's correct, but it didn't work out due to the fact that funding ran out, so I had to work full-time.
Uh-huh.
So I ended up working and going to school, and I had to leave because of lack of funding at around the time of the dot-com bubble bursting in 2000.
And
so
I think,
it made it very difficult for me.
Yeah, I think this is a really important point. We have now this, as we're calling it, the financial meltdown in the United States, and actually military recruitment and enlistment has gone way up. Is there, in your mind, a correlation between people going into the military and not being able to get work in the United States?
Yes, that's a very important point, because if you look at the statistics in the U.S. military, over 60% are from low-income families. And the reason why that is because people look at the military as a last resort in order to jumpstart their life. I know this from personal experience because that's what I did. And now that we have this economic crisis, the U.S. military's rank definitely will swell because people need to find a place that has a steady job, the benefits, the chance to go to school, the medical care, everything. So this is definitely a direct correlation between the two.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why we sometimes call it the U.S. military, the mercenary army of the poor.
Mm-hmm. Or the poverty draft, right?
Correct. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What would you like American parents to know about your situation and how you got here.
American parents?
You were older when you went into the military. A lot of young people are going in, 17, 18-year-olds are going into the military. What do you think their parents should know about how the system works, the military system works?
Well, if I were the parents of a child who was either approached by a recruiter or even expressed interest in the military, I would suggest to the parents to learn all they can, not just from mainstream media or from the Army recruitment centers, but they need to really do the research. Go to your libraries, go on the internet, speak to people who have been in the military, speak to Vietnam vets, speak to Iraq vets, let people understand, especially the veterans. Take those kids to veteran hospitals and talk to people who are, you know, who've seen the war up close and personal, people who have either suffered, you know, mental anguish from it or suffered bodily harm, and show them what war is really like. Because the biggest problem is that a lot of people treat war like it's a video game. This is one of the propaganda tools that are used to get people to join, that it's just nothing but one big adventure. But once you put on that uniform, either your life can be taken or somebody else's life can be taken, and that's a very serious matter that everybody should consider.
Yeah, it's not something that goes away when you get back home. In fact, it often gets worse when you get back home because there's no one really who understands your situation having been in the combat, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's correct. And because even now, I mean, I still have to live with the fact that I helped kill a whole bunch of people for nothing. Mm-hmm. And this is something that you really have to deal with. Some people handle it in different ways. I'm sure you've heard about the stories about the suicide rate accelerating within the U.S. Army in particular. And right now the Army's not really saying what the reasons are, but the biggest primary reason is because of post-traumatic stress syndrome, and also with the fact that the soldiers are realizing that the very enemy that we're supposed to be stopping is us. And this is a very important point to mention, because when you wake up to that fact one day, it's very devastating.
Mm-hmm. Well, Andre Shepherd, we're going to stay in touch with you and follow the story. When do you expect the next piece of information to come down that will affect your case?
The next substantial piece of information that directly affects the case, hopefully either end of summer or throughout the end of the year. We do not know when the decision will come down from the Bundesamt, because since it's such a complex case, they have to not only look at their own laws, they have to look at European law, UN law, and most likely probably the U.S. Constitution, because we also cited that the U.S. Constitution was also in violation of in this war, because since we totally treated the UN Charter as garbage, we violated our own law, the supreme law of the land, especially when the Constitution says that any foreign treaty is treated at the same status as the Constitution. And that's a very important point that people need to understand.
Well, Andre, you're invited to come back and keep us aware of what is going on with the case, and I thank you for being with us.
Oh, thank you very much for having me on and allowing your listeners to get some information.
My grandpa fought in World War II, my uncle fought in Nam. My father was too young, he went to school and met my mom. And her dad always told us stories around dinner time. And there's one he told when I was young that sticks out in my mind. He said 10 years after that he taught me about the birds and bees. I was stranded in Pearl Harbor fighting off the Japanese. When the kamikaze pilots came and dove in without warning, I was on the Arizona on a warm December morning. I remember when I was a younger man, we were soldiers fighting in a foreign land. Now I'm hard to have forgiveness for the things they did that day. And our president decided we should make their people pay. So we dropped on Nagasaki and we cut them down to size. And the one we dropped on Hiroshima left them vaporized. And I heard some Christians say, what would Jesus do? What if you were on the wrong side? Would he point the gun at you? And they read through every word of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John, so they could see if killing was the side that Christ was on. I remember when I was a younger man, we were soldiers fighting in a foreign land. Now I'm older, and it's happening again. And they separate the church and state.
It's Griffin House with I Remember It's Happening Again. Not-for-profit organization Rebuilding Alliance rebuilds homes and communities in regions of war and occupation and advocates for government policies towards these regions based on human rights and international law. Their projects are symbols of hope that help rebuild shattered communities and offer people around the world immediate ways to make peace, starting with tangible support of a family's right to a home. I want to welcome Executive Director of the Rebuilding Alliance, Donna Baranski-Walker. Welcome.
Very exciting to be here. Thank you.
It's really great to have you because I think, first of all, you're a local organization, and I think people in Palo Alto should know about this. And we're going to do that today. We're going to help them know. But I also want to recognize, Donna, that you have a very interesting history yourself. You have an electrical engineering degree from MIT, and with that you went to Siberia. So before we get into the Rebuilding Alliance, talk a little about the direction that you were heading in and then how you got into the work that you're in today.
Sure, thank you. I guess what I do now is work on peacemaking, and the question that draws me to it is how one can use technology in creative ways to address war and peace and abilities to link people together that have never existed before. So I guess I'm not unusual, and a number of engineers have sought to find ways to use these tools creatively. What brought me to it, though, is kind of odd or interesting. When I was in engineering school, one friend, Rodney Burroughs, had said, very important to go on an exchange program. At that time, it was during in the middle of the Cold War. There was an exchange between the YMCA and the Komsomol that would send 6 Americans to Siberia and 6 Russians to Houston, of all places. And I got to meet the other team. They were very homesick. Oh. Houston was not the best place to go. So I was part of a delegation that would go there. And then I stayed and studied in Poland for the remainder of the year. And because that was the first invasion of Afghanistan, I ended up leaving my studies early and traveling throughout all of Eastern Europe, often staying illegally in people's homes, because as Western foreigners during the Cold War, it was something that wasn't allowed for many, many people. Mm. It was very, it just certainly had a big impact on me. I became bolder about the way I wanted to use my work, my studies, and also ended up using the ideas that I learned in that trip later on in an essay that I wrote that was published in the New York Times, a way of ending the then standoff with Iraq without going to war. And that essay was translated by the First Lady of Greece and carried to the Iraqi Women's Federation. Mm. Thousands of people seemed to participate in that, and it set me off on a path of really pursuing this type of piecework, this type of connecting people across vast distances.
And at this point, you are focused more on Israel and Gaza.
Yeah, our work at the Rebuilding Alliance, I'd spent a good part, a number of years, working on connecting teachers in the Middle East. And the project did get off the ground, but in the process, I realized that I wanted to show people what I was seeing in visiting teachers in Israel, throughout Gaza, and the West Bank, and Jordan. I wanted Americans to see some of the lessons or personal stories that were so important that came up for me. And a good way to begin to help people make a difference, to support peacemakers, encourage moderate voices was to help people rebuild. And so we began working in East Jerusalem with Israelis and Palestinians rebuilding demolished Palestinian homes, and then expanded to the West Bank and also into Gaza. So all of those areas, often as possible, bringing Israelis and Palestinians together to do the rebuilding work. And we say as possible because it's not been possible to do that, bringing Israelis into Gaza, although there's ways that we're pulling those projects together as well.
Before we talk about some of the ways that you're pulling them together, I want to go back to your saying that some of these stories you felt you wanted to share here in the United States. Talk a little bit about why you felt that way. It seems to me as though some of those stories are not getting out enough. And that's why I would do it, for example. And I'm wondering if that's why you were doing it.
Well, once you go into people's homes, once they tell you their stories and you see something that's not what you expected at all. I'd written a proposal that the World Bank thought was interesting, and I'd had all these high-level meetings at first with education ministers and such, but there came a time when I had to go and see if my ideas made sense with teachers and principals, and I crossed from Israel into the West Bank by myself, and I was terrified at that moment of, you know, what would I experience. My fear was unfounded, and the reception I had from everyone, all sides, was just different from what I expected, except that in a very deep way, I really believed that people aren't that much different, and I held to that belief, overcoming whatever fear to you know, go and make the trip. So how do you begin to tell these stories in a way that others can overcome either their fears or their biases? It seemed that just getting the chance to show the things that draw me to the area, it has to do with the personal stories, with the resilience of people who are willing to work together despite significant challenges, and are determined to succeed and give it their best every day. I really appreciate that opportunity.
I don't want to put you on the spot here, but I wonder if you could share one of those stories. And if you can't, that's fine. We can come back to it. But a story that happened when you, for example, crossed over that boundary. Somebody met you. How did you get introduced to the first families? It was in Gaza when you first crossed the border?
Well, I went in 96, so it was a good time for the peace process overall, except if one paid attention to what was going on in Hebron. There was already great signs of things falling apart. When I went to talk with teachers in those first meetings, I think just the Friends School in Ramallah, the challenge to me was to cross back and forth and hear stories on either side and then figure out how to cope with them. So the principle at the
how
Friends,
to emotionally cope with them,
even just like people willing to connect with each other but so far out of touch with one another. So I'd be having, you know, a polite dinner with a group of people from like the Children's Museum in the Jerusalem area who wanted to get all kinds of museum, science museum pieces and such to schools in Ramallah. And in the school in Ramallah, even the Friends School, which is pretty much a school for just, it's a very well respected school, maybe an elite school in some ways. There, the students had recently gone out to throw rocks at helicopters because everyone was protesting the tunnels that were now being dug under Jerusalem and had caused such overwhelming hopelessness, rage. Now, the teachers were talking about the helicopters shooting at the students and the injuries coming in, and they're trying to keep the students in class and having everyone run out to the hillsides. And I don't know, the futility of the story and the sadness of what was going on. And And then how to tell, you know, where does one begin with that? I don't know, just hard things to cope with.
The thing that strikes me now, you will talk a little bit more when we start talking about these projects, you'll talk about the group Combatants for Peace. And this is Israeli and Palestinians getting together to try and find ways to work together and understand one another. And the thing that really struck me early on was how the Israeli soldiers would say, well, I've never really talked to a Palestinian before if he wasn't at the other end of my gun or in a combat zone, you know, if we weren't there as part of a combat project. And the Palestinians say the same thing. We don't talk to the Israelis. And I mean, that's just on a social level. There is absolutely no communication going on except through on one side or another of a gun a lot of the time.
Yeah, that's certainly true. But then there are the peacemakers, you know, the people who choose to work with the other side and who see their common enemy being occupation mm-hmm. or violence and who stand up against their neighbors even to continue that set of relationships that bring them closer together.
And let's give a shout out for some of those folks. So there's the Machsom Watch, the people that go to the checkpoints. There's New Profiles. There's a number. There's Family Bereaved Family Circle, I believe it's called, or Family Circle.
Indeed. And in Sderot, there's a group called Other Voices. And then the village group, they were determined to connect with Gaza all through the crisis and before that. In the Other Voice group, 2,500 people signed a petition saying that they wanted to continue the lull, the ceasefire, that there would be no point in upgrading and attacking, mm-hmm. and they couldn't stop it from happening. Matzom Watch, certainly very important, that women standing at the checkpoint trying to ease the daily
crisis that goes on.
Yeah.
You've been there, I've been there, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, you've seen those happening. So Rebuilding Alliance addresses this, and Rebuilding Alliance tries to do it in an even-handed way.
Right. We just finished a speaking tour with Combatants for Peace. There was a little girl hit by a rubber bullet, and when her picture went around the world in a condolence book, I couldn't just sign the book. I thought there had to be something more that we could do. My board said, give them a call and see if the family would like any help. And the family said they didn't want any help for themselves, but they wanted a way to build something for her classmates. Her chair would be empty at school. And they asked that Combatants for Peace do the construction of a playground at their school. So Rebuilding Alliance took on a partnership relationship with Combatants for Peace and brought that family to speak, but also the Combatants for Peace to come and speak in the United States. And on our recent speaking tour, we were in 14 synagogues and 4 mosques and many, many churches and universities and high schools. But then we also spoke at the United Nations and in Congress, and very interesting to see the level of access this time in this Congress, where Senator Kerry met with us twice and Congressman met with us directly.
Since this last election.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Interesting. A good sign. Mm-hmm. The Combatants for Peace are former soldiers, Israeli soldiers, and Palestinians who've been in Israeli prisons, all of whom set aside revenge and choose not to use violence and work together to end the occupation. So people following the news, when President Obama spoke out against settlements just over the weekend, the Combatants for Peace went over to one of the settlement outposts to protest and to insist that the outpost be removed. And these are Israeli former soldiers and Palestinian fighters, former fighters, deciding that they would stand up in this peaceful way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's important to mention, as you have already, of course, that there's a large contingency of peace people there and that they need as much support as they can get because their voices tend to be drowned out a lot. I think in the media that we get here, there's a sense that those peace people are marginalized. But in fact, they're very active and they're very effective.
It seems really important to amplify what they're doing in any way that we can. Mm-hmm. That it has to be the hope for any society seeking peace that its former fighters would get together, that they would choose to be the vanguard or the opening point for change in the society. And I think that's what's drawing our politicians toward that, and you know, something that we as constituents should be pursuing, to let our politicians know that there is an opening. These two groups do exist, and to speak out in support and encouragement for these groups.
I'm just looking at the recent campaign victories you've had. You talk about the Courage of Conscience speaking tour, I Care About Peace, I Care About Al-Aqba campaign. Let's go through each of these. The Courage of Conscience speaking tour, for example.
So that was with Combatants for Peace. That's the one we've just been talking about that brought us to speak at the UN and in Congress and all. And it's interesting because the next playground, Abir's Garden, A Safe Place to Grow, it'll be built not far from Hebron. And five congressmen said they want to come to the opening of the playground. So I hope we'll be able to finish that soon and bring it into the news with much more of a reception from mm-hmm. Congress.
And finishing it soon requires funding.
Oh, yeah, always. And maybe that's more giving people the opportunity to help. Mm-hmm. You know, one feels often that there's nothing you can do to make a difference, the peace is intractable, but it makes a big difference. You know, giving the chance for children to see the playground being built by former soldiers, children who've maybe never seen anyone but a soldier with a gun pointed at them, instead seeing soldiers come and help to build their playground. And then for the adults, for the former soldiers and former fighters, that they can see that life goes on, that the children have a place to play, that parents' clubs are supporting their activities. All of that is a good step toward healing and toward giving all involved a way to engage with each other.
And you have, you're working on the soccer shoes.
Oh yeah, that's soccer shoes. In Gaza, our dream is to do building projects. There's 20,000 homes that have had their windows and doors knocked out and huge cracks in the walls, but no building supplies are being allowed through the blockade as yet. So where does one begin on something as difficult as a whole siege or blockade of Gaza? Well, our partners there, we rebuilt the home that Rachel Corrie had stood to protect in Gaza. And
that was your first home, wasn't it?
It was the first home in Gaza. So in partnership with Gaza Community Mental Health Program, great family. And the reason that she stood in front of that bulldozer was she knew the children were inside of that house. And so we've worked with them for years now. And with the current crisis in Gaza, like, where does one begin? Well, they said start with soccer, that there's a field that they cleared on the no man's zone in Rafah, Gaza. And they've been hosting tournaments, and they just clear the field off of any munitions, anything left over that, you know, because the bombings are continuing there. And everyone comes out to play, and they're playing soccer in what they call the Unity Soccer Field, mm. Unity Club Soccer Field. So when they said start with soccer, they're asking for help to put in a portable office unit where they can store water and have a bathroom and all. And then besides that, they said, well, what about soccer shoes? And so we've asked everyone to donate gently worn sports shoes, even don't have to be soccer shoes, and bring it to our office on Alma Street in Palo Alto. It's really interesting about how we'll get those shoes in and how we'll ramp up to building materials, but there is a clear path that makes that possible. We even got it on the negotiation list for the State Department. So,
well, let's make sure that people know how to get hold of you. You mentioned Alma Street, but it's 235 Alma Street, Palo Alto. That's just off El Camino. And also rebuildingalliance.org is one way to get in touch.
Yes, indeed. And feel free to call us. Let us know if you want to be in touch. We'll figure out a way to pick up your soccer shoes.
Pick up your soccer shoes, or if you want something to do for the summer, there's always space.
Right. We have internships for all of our projects. We're asking people who would like to intern with us or volunteer with us. There's stories to be told and work to be done in building with Combatants for Peace, with the kindergarten in the West Bank and the soccer program. It's also a legal case that we've been pursuing about the Leahy Amendment. And so very interesting opportunities.
Talk about that.
Well, our work is to rebuild in conflict zones and to make them safe. And what we're doing is trying to mobilize the influence of Congress. It's not often a bill in Congress, but it's when a congressman, when a friend of Israel calls the Israeli embassy and urges restraint or urges a change in policy, they'll get an answer. So having constituents connect with congresspeople is very important. And one particular law turns out to be worth examining in detail. When I mentioned about the little girl hit by a rubber bullet, her case was dismissed in the
I'm going to interrupt you for a second. She was killed.
She was killed, mm-hmm. Right. A rubber-coated steel bullet, and she's 10 years old. A quiet street, the sound of one bullet, and she's hit and passes away after 3 days in the hospital. There's a law, a U.S. law, it's called the Leahy Amendment, and it's an amendment to appropriation laws. It says that when a member of a military unit has committed a crime, and if it's not brought to justice, then the U.S. must withhold funding, aid, and training from the unit involved, unless the Secretary of State can show that the justice will be pursued. So it's a very specific rule, and it's invoked very quietly. This law has been in place for about 9 years. It's invoked all around the world wherever we provide aid and funding and training. This is quietly pursued. And our particular case of the little girl, Abir Aramin, she would qualify under this rule because her investigation was withdrawn. And then appealed, and again, the appeal was denied. So, in her case, where an army jeep passed by on the street, and it was again a quiet street with 14 witnesses, it seems very strong that the case should invoke the Leahy Amendment, at least to the point of bringing the perpetrators to justice. So. We've pursued it. We translated all the court materials. A very famous lawyer in Israel, Michal Sfard, is prosecuting on this case. He's the attorney representing the family on the case, misstated. We were able to bring him to present it to the State Department. And so we took the translated 150 pages of court record and the attorney and made a presentation. This was after we'd brought the family and had her case entered into the Human Rights Report last year. So
there was something that the Rebuilding Alliance did.
Yeah, it's part of that part mm-hmm. of our mission to mm-hmm. make it safe. Mm-hmm. You know, that you couldn't just build a playground for the little children. You had to do your best to make sure that there wouldn't be harassment from soldiers, that they would be as safe as possible. And maybe... you know, we've seen every level of human rights prosecution withdrawn in with regard to Israel and Palestine. The Leahy Amendment should apply. It should be a way to bring about an investigation, and even more importantly, change the tenor of what becomes an ever-escalating level of violence. That doesn't end, as Michal Sfard said, it doesn't go away just because you want it to go away. It goes away when you call people on it, when you speak out and make it change. So that's our hope in this case.
Before we go on to another project that you're working on, I want to remind our listeners that we're talking with Donna Berinsky-Walker of the Rebuilding Alliance, which is right here in Palo Alto, 235 Alma Street. And listeners can learn more at rebuildingalliance.org. Talk a little bit about the urgent action to save the kindergarten and village of Al-Aqaba from demolition.
Yeah, Al-Aqaba, we thought it was our safest case. And we had a small grant to help build a school that wouldn't be demolished again. We went to a village in the West Bank that had just won its case before the Israeli Supreme Court. And the court had ruled that Israeli soldiers' training camp had to be removed from the village grounds. So the village was very excited. They were ready to rebuild. The kindergarten was needed to a new roof, and we had a small grant. I came back 3 months later, and they were digging a new foundation. I'm like, I thought we were just putting in a new roof. And they're like, oh, yes, but it has to be a much stronger set of walls for the roof that we have envisioned. When I later got the photograph, they'd built two floors even. It was much bigger than I expected. The kindergarten has 130 students. The Japanese, Belgian, and Norwegian governments helped build the second floor. Pretty remarkable. But as we were building, the whole village came under demolition orders. The mosque, the little medical clinic, the kindergarten, all of the homes except for two are all slated for demolition.
On what grounds?
That's the weird part about it. You know, like, what for? Building without a permit, ostensibly. But that's a false premise. And I say that because this is a village in Area C. It turns out that none of the villages in Area C are being granted building permits. And this is 60% of the West Bank.
Let's talk about areas A, B, and C. I'm assuming our listeners know something, but in case they don't, let's just do a reminder.
So from the Oslo Accords, there were designations of jurisdiction. Area A was given to what would become the Palestinian Authority, and they would have control over security and administration. So any land or permits would be governed by the Palestinian government, which is not quite a full government, but an authority. Area B was to be under Palestinian administration, jointly administered by Israeli army and Palestinian security for matters of security. So there used to be a joint policing function. And then Area C, the 60% of the West Bank that includes the Jordan River Valley, that was to be administered and security provided for exclusively by the Israeli government. And it's that area where little village of El Aqaba is located. El Aqaba happens to be very far from the wall, not close to any settlements, and not close to any borders. So it seemed like a good bet for a village that shouldn't have any real problems facing it, but instead it has this nearly 100% demolition order. Anyway, we helped take it to the Israeli High Court. Just before we took it to the Israeli High Court, I thought, my goodness, you know, we're an awfully small nonprofit, and how on earth are we going to help save this place where, you know, it was one of my first projects building the kindergarten. I didn't want to see it destroyed. So I actually moved my office to a tent in front of the Palo Alto City Hall, and the city council gave us right to put up a banner. It takes a village to save a village, and it was remarkable to see that did help. Within 3 days, I was in front of Congress, and everybody across the country was calling in about El Aqaba, and then we got a grant to put in a new library in the kindergarten building, and then we brought the mayor of the village to speak in Congress, and also the kindergarten director. Interesting challenge, because the mayor is paraplegic and in a wheelchair.
And I believe there is a video of him who actually speaks Hebrew. Of course, it's transcribed into English subtitles, but it's on your website, isn't it?
Right, right. And also the village made its own video of something called Pinwheels for Peace. They were the first village in the Middle East to join the international movement Pinwheels for Peace. Very exciting to see that happen.
So I didn't mean to interrupt your story, but I do want people to go www.rebuildingalliance.org, and you can see that video.
He spoke to Congress in Hebrew, actually, and we brought a colleague from BIMCOM, the Israeli group Planners for Planning Rights, who give the full background of that village and what was happening there. So we brought the BIMCOM co-founder and the mayor of El Aqaba. We will have them on our teleconference programs coming soon. I think we'll restart that next week, Wednesday. And this gives people, we call it the Sweep Down the Walls teleconference series, and it'll give people a chance to join us with these speakers calling in from Israel and from the West Bank, so that they can, they'll be able to answer questions, brainstorm with the audience, and really pay attention to what Obama has said is a major issue, settlement expansion, and the flip side of what are the village rights.
So what happened with that demolition order?
It's still standing. There's another case pending. We're pressing for the village to be able to file its building plan, its master plan. So like any other village in the world, you know, when you're a town, you issue building permits in accordance with your plan, and that's what should be happening there. It'll be a precedent-setting case, and we look forward to that happening. Very important.
Well, Donna, it's been really great to have you. And again, Donna Brinsky-Walker at Rebuilding Alliance, www.rebuildingalliance.org or 235 Alma. You're always looking for interesting people to drop by, especially if they come prepared with help in any
sure.
way.
Sure, and we're also selling organic olive oil from Palestine.
Oh, so exactly. You have actually two kinds.
Right, right. Rumi and Nabali tree. So most welcome to come and try the olive oil.
And I want to just add, the Rumi is actually an ancient Roman olive tree. And the
Nabali is more indigenous, right?
And
right.
They have very strong flavors. So yes, do that. Come by and get olive oil too, or go to the website.
Yes, please do.
And I'm going to actually end with Samir Gibran's music. He is Palestinian, and I think that this is a fitting end. And thank you for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me. What a pleasure.
It's a little different, isn't it? There's someone who's going to... And we do.